Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Mark Schwarzer, and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Phil Kitromilidis. Phil, how's it going, mate?
Hello, Schwartzy. There's really only one place for us to start this week, isn't there? And that's, unfortunately, with your beloved Socceroos, who were knocked out of the Asian Cup over the weekend by South Korea at the quarter-final stage. A heartbreaking loss. Sorry, I don't mean to label the point, but it really was. It really was quite a dramatic defeat for the Socceroos. Joining us for this pod is a man who played 28 times in the green and gold, Tommy Orr. Hello, Tommy. Welcome to the pod.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a shame that we've got Tommy on in these circumstances, you know, to talk about the Socceroos' exit from the Asian Cup. Obviously, everyone listening will know what happened in the game. But if you didn't, Australia winning 1-0, deep into injury time, they conceded and then lost in extra time, 2-1, the final score. I just want to get your guys' sort of initial reactions to the game itself and then maybe the tournament as a whole. But the game, Mark, I guess it was a question of, you know, so near, so far, just, you know, seconds away from seeing out what would have been a massive win. What did you feel of the performance overall from Australia?
I came away bitterly disappointed, of course, like pretty much everyone else did, I think. More so because I felt that literally, what, 2 minutes away from making it through, I thought they did almost everything right, other than, obviously, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but the defensive kind of changes to the shape, dropping too deep, didn't really play their game, which is a natural tendency to do when you are winning late in a game in a knockout tournament. It tends to happen. But I think it's a tale of just missed chances. Australia take their chances. Even just another one of their chances. I mean, they had three other massive, massive chances. The game's done. And that's the biggest disappointment. I thought it was one of their best performances of the tournament. And I said it before, they hadn't played particularly well, but who cares? They kept getting through each round. Whereas now there's an opportunity for criticism because they get knocked out and maybe not, and certainly not performed at the level that we saw them play at the World Cup. But I thought they were slow burner moving into it, getting better and better and stronger in the tournament as it came on. So that's probably the biggest disappointment for me. And I think it was a common trait throughout the tournament up until that point, is that we weren't ruthless enough in front of goal. We did not take our chances. We didn't punish teams enough. And that's how I feel and my overriding feeling after that game.
Tommy, feel free to wildly disagree with Mark. I get the feeling that you kind of agree with what he's saying.
No, I think that's coming later in the pod, but I think, he's bang on this time. So, it's obviously not too much to add, really, but I think, you know, games are won and lost in the box and at both ends of the pitch. So, and I think that rang true in this game, you know, like Schwartzy touched on. I think Juki had two big chances. Metcalf had one, you know, that. If you miss these chances, you always have that feeling that you might live to kind of rue missing them. And obviously, we all know what happened at the end with Lewis Miller's unfortunate foul in the box. And you know those kind of moments prove to be the difference.
Tommy, one player that for me that was kind of I don't want to be critical, but I was disappointed in their overall performance of the tournament was Martin Boyle. I thought I was expecting so much more from him. I'm a big fan. I think he's a really good player. He adds a different dimension to the Socceroos. He had a double chance in that game. The other thing I was going to ask you is Graham Arnold's decisions to take him and Craig Goodwin off. That for me, that was just way too defensive.
I think I agree completely, and I think also it was quite early as well. You know, as soon as you're kind of accept and take off your attacking-minded players, it's kind of you're just defending wave after wave of attack. And, you know, I think the best kind of defense is to keep the ball and to pose a threat at the other end of the pitch yourself, I think. And, you know, the benefit of hindsight, it's always easy to nitpick and make these comments, but I do wholeheartedly agree. And I think, you know, Nathaniel Atkinson coming off as well. I think that was a real turning point in the game because I actually thought he had a fantastic game up until the point he came off. And, you know, you can only assume he probably ran himself into the ground at that stage. But, yeah, I think that, like you touched on, they were kind of key changes and key moments of the game. And, yeah, like you said, I think a lot of the players in our front third, I thought they were probably the ones who didn't have quite the tournament, Martin Ball included, that we hoped that they would.
I was looking for some reaction online on social media, which I know is a dangerous thing because social media isn't always representative and it is pretty visceral and emotional. But one comment I came across was somebody said, are we just going to play counter-attacking football forever? And it got me thinking, I mean, do Australia have the players, have the ability to play a little bit more? Because you look at the statistics here, it's 26% possession. The passing accuracy is 68%. As you said, Tommy, they were dropping super deep. The way that you can see out these games is by holding on to possession and you know, that's how you defend. Do Australia have the ability to play a little bit differently and play a little bit better?
I think we do, and I think that's kind of one of the main lessons we need to take away from this tournament, because particularly in World Cup qualifying in Asia, you know, most of the games we're going to have a lot of the ball and we're going to have to dictate the game and, you know, really control the possession and create chances. And I think that, like Schwartzy mentioned at the start, I think that's where we really were disappointing in this tournament. I think that, you know, in the World Cup and also against Korea, when we're versing maybe stronger opponents than ourselves, and we can kind of stay compact and look to launch counterattacks, that's when we've actually looked our most comfortable and looked our most threatening. And I think we need to be more adaptable against these kind of, you can call them lower quality opposition, to really take control of the game. And, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to selection as well, because it's clear that Arnie likes the kind of physical, robust, you know, style of player, and we've obviously got them in abundance. But I think that, you know, we've also got players like Sammy Silvera. I would have loved to have seen him get more game time in this tournament. And I think he's one that, you know, in the tight spaces, he can create an opening with his pace and his excellent technique. And obviously he wasn't at the tournament, but even Cammy Devlin, I think he's the kind of player when you've got possession of the ball with his intelligent passes around the corner, that they can really make openings that we didn't really have in this tournament. And I think that it's going to be an important lesson to learn going forward, to be more adaptable.
Cammy Devlin's always an interesting one to me, because I agree with you. Like, I'm always a bit surprised to see him, well, not a bit, very surprised not to have seen him involved, first and foremost, with the Socceroos sooner. Then when he did get given an opportunity, why isn't he involved more often? I find that fascinating, that discussion. Look, I thought Backus in midfield, I think he's very lively, very good. I think he's a player that certainly you can build a midfield around. But someone like Cammy Devlin can be that player that can, I think, certainly have the ability to hold onto the ball more. But then you can only hold on for so long, right, Tommy? You need to have an outlet, right? So you need to have players up front. You need to have a system in place that, and I'm not just saying, look, this is just Mitchell Duke, right? It's not. It's, you've got to have players around, right? You can't just have one player. It doesn't matter how good the player is. He could be like the Mark Viduka of the world. He's not going to keep the ball forever. You've got to support them. And I don't think we do that enough. And the thought of like playing that counter football was something that we've continued all the way through. And even in the earlier stages of this tournament, it's something that we've relied on heavily. I always find that more recently, we struggle to break teams down. We struggle to... when we do have more possession, it's almost like, okay, what do we do? How do we move the ball quickly across from one side to the other? Is it a case of giving more players touches and the transition of the ball is slower from one side of the pitch to the other? There just doesn't seem to be a real philosophy in that regard going forward of how to actually dominate teams when we are the superior team, and how do we break teams down and be more ruthless? We just are not ruthless enough.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think if you go one step further and you kind of look at the last kind of couple of years and all the goals we have scored, a lot of them do seem to be from, you know, getting the ball into wide areas and then using our aerial domination in the box and getting crosses into the box. But I think that, you know, you need to have more elements to it than that. I think we need more players in the pocket to be less predictable. So, you know, if everyone knows the crosses are coming in, it's easy to defend. So I think we need to add kind of more strings to our bow and maybe look at a few different personnel as well to, you know, since the likes of Aaron Moy and Tom Rogic have retired, we haven't really replaced them with those kind of players, those technical players that are so comfortable on the ball in the middle of the park. And I think we do have some young ones coming through that could potentially fulfill kind of the shoes that they left.
For me, one player that's obviously we've been missing sorely throughout the last 12 months, 18 months is Aiden Rustich. Because I think he's a player that's got that creativity. He's got the ability to be in those pockets, can score from distance, but also can create. So there's a combination of obviously having a bad injury and then not playing club team football. But there's a couple of players that went to this Asian Cup that didn't play a lot of football. And so, like, I know Rustich is fit, but he wasn't selected. And then other players who are fit and haven't been playing for their clubs have gone. So there is that selection thing, right? There is those question marks over, okay, do you forgo a player of Rustich's quality and individual brilliance and technical ability for a player that is more hardworking, more robust? And I think that's what Arnie's gone along, right? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's kind of I think Arnie would probably admit himself that he chose a squad that didn't have options to mix it up. I think we had a lot of the same kind of profile of player. So, you know, even if you made a substitution, it was kind of a like-for-like change. We didn't really have that circuit breaker or any kind of versatility to change the game plan, you know, because we were obviously going to come up against different challenges like we've touched on, but we didn't have the versatility to deal with that. And I think Frostich is obviously one who's, you know, technically probably our best player. And I think he definitely would have added a lot for sure.
I don't want to rub it in, guys, but this does feel like a massive opportunity loss, doesn't it? Because get through this game against South Korea and it's Jordan, Iran and Qatar left in the tournament. It would have been a fantastic chance to win it again.
Oh, huge. You know, the thing about it is, right, so like we kind of go on paper and go Iran, not very... I mean, they knocked out Japan. I mean, Japan, yeah, on paper should have won this tournament, in my opinion, hands down, on paper. But we know that that doesn't always work, right? So there's something seriously not right with that Japanese side, because that squad of players, they should be flying in this tournament. So yeah, the draw opens up, or did open up very nicely. For me, obviously, South Korea have got to be still one of the favourites to win the tournament now, being the biggest name, the biggest, highest ranked team in those last four teams. But we've seen throughout this tournament that counts for nothing if you don't go out there and perform. And I think that was that win for South Korea was a job-saving win for Jürgen Klinsmann, because he was on the verge. If they got knocked out, I think he was gone. And he's also his whole tone, because the criticism I've seen leading up to the tournament or throughout the tournament is the lack of emotion and smiling too much on the sideline. That whole game, he was fully involved, fully emotional and animated on the sideline. And that was a huge victory, not just for South Korea, but also for Jürgen Klinsmann.
Completely agree. And I think that playing in the Middle East does add a little bit of a different element, though, because, you know, if we had won this game, we'd be up against Jordan next. But you look at the Socceroos' kind of record against Jordan over the last, you know, 12 years, and it's not very good, actually. So I think that, you know,
away from home is not good. At home, it's dominating, but exactly. Away from home, it's very, very hit and miss. If anything, I don't know the stat exactly, but I think Jordan potentially would have the upper hand on us away from home.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, the conditions and probably the support in Qatar would be very much for Jordan. So it would have been difficult regardless of who we're going to come up against at this stage in the tournament. But you can't help but, you know, that think what if, and I think that does leave a little bit of, it's kind of a bit of extra salt in the wound, having lost that game the way we did, knowing that Japan is out for sure.
Well, Korea's going to win the semi-final. South Korea's going to win the semi-final with a 99th minute winner, obviously. And then they're going to win the final with a 110th minute winner, because they've been doing it lastminute.com in every single game. So it's going to happen again, I think.
Possible. It's absolutely possible. You know, the thing about it is, I just think you can only go so far doing that, right? You can't rely that all the time.
But they've got pretty far.
I know. But look, for me, the likes of Japan, South Korea, Australia, semi-finals is a given. That's what you need to accomplish, right? And we haven't done it, obviously. Japan haven't done it. South Korea, the only one of the so-called big hitters that have done it. So yeah, there's a lot of football still to be played, and South Korea need to be better to win this tournament based on the other team's performances thus far throughout this tournament.
What about the momentum in terms of this tournament helping, you know, grow the game in Australia? Because we've seen the momentum of how Australia did really well at the World Cup, the Men's World Cup, and then the Women's World Cup obviously galvanised everyone. Was this maybe a chance for the tournament to get even more people interested in soccer in Australia, or was the time differences and everything maybe not the tournament to get everyone behind the team? I'm interested to hear, Tommy, how you feel that this tournament has helped with that aspect of it.
Yeah, I don't feel like this tournament's had the hype or the gravity that the previous kind of tournaments have. But at the same time, you know, in the Asian Cup, even when we hosted the Asian Cup in Australia in 2015, it wasn't until you kind of got to the quarters and the semis where you really started to feel the anticipation and that kind of feeling of excitement around the country. I think that, you know, had we won this game, I think there'd be a lot of discussion and people talking about, oh, hold on, we might actually go on to win this thing. But, you know, losing in the quarterfinal, I think we didn't really quite reach that moment yet. And obviously that's a little bit disappointing. But overall, you know, I think that more broadly speaking on your point, I think that, you know, the Socceroos and the Matildas and the football brand in Australia, generally speaking, from a national team perspective at least, is as strong as it's been in the last kind of, you know, 8 years for sure, 10 years maybe. So I think we're in a good place and it's kind of a good platform to grow from, and got some exciting years to come for sure.
I think for the branding, definitely, not necessarily the performances. Obviously for the Socceroos, there's the biggest issue. Matildas did remarkably well at a home World Cup, which kind of was the bare minimum. You kind of hoped that they'd have reached the semi-final because being at a home World Cup and having all that advantage in so many aspects. But I thought they were brilliant throughout the tournament. Not necessarily every performance, but the way that they dealt with the pressure, I thought was outstanding. The Socceroos is an interesting one. And I think we are also experiencing the other effect of the Matildas doing so well at a home World Cup, and then the Socceroos post the Qatar World Cup, now Asian Cup, where people just think, well, look, we are one of the top three teams in this tournament and we should at the very least get to the semi-final, if not to the final. I think the Asian Cup still, the diehard football fan is interested. The general wider public isn't. And that's kind of the very contrast to a World Cup, which is understandable. And the World Cup is a World Cup, right? So we're always going to have that battle. And I think Tommy's absolutely spot on. It's when they get to this, you know, really to the semi-final and beyond, is when people then start, the wider audience start to become a little bit more interested in what the Socceroos might be doing. But there's also that case of, well, it's only an Asian Cup. But for us as footballers, we know how big it is and we know what it's worth and how much we, you know, how desperate you are to try and win it. So I think the Socceroos are in an interesting place because off the back of the World Cup in Qatar, they were outstanding. They overperformed in so many aspects. I said it many, many times, the best team we've ever sent to a World Cup, not the best individuals, but the best team, certainly from performances wise throughout it. And that's the grit and the determination, having like nearly zero expectation outside of that group to accomplish what they did and really make Australia proud, football fans proud, and get people on that journey was outstanding. With that, there are knock-on effects, right? So you've got to then carry that forward. And the Socceroos haven't capitalized on that success of the World Cup post it. This tournament was an absolute brilliant opportunity for them to capitalize on it. And unfortunately, it didn't work out for us and we were 2 minutes away from it happening.
Yeah, I completely agree with Schwartzy. And I think if you look now where we kind of stand going into the next kind of World Cup qualifying campaign, you know, I think there are a few concerns because you look at our kind of our front third in particular, you know, the likes of Mitch Duke and Craig Goodwin, Martin Boyle, I think they're all, you know, well over 30 now. None of them are getting any younger. And obviously the next kind of generation coming through doesn't really have that experience or exposure yet at this level. So I think there is a little bit of a gap there. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see how Arnie kind of navigates that in the coming kind of period, whether he's going to, you know, not make a clean out or clean out the squad, but whether he's going to start to make a more aggressive transition to some younger players, or what his strategy is going to be around that. Because I think a lot of these players, they're going to be too old to play in the next World Cup. potentially. So he's going to have to do some serious thinking. And yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And there might be some changes in the squad in the coming period for sure.
Right, that's the discussion about the Socceroos and the disappointment of them being knocked out in the quarterfinals against South Korea. Almost there, 2 minutes to go. Anyway, let's just move on. I'm going to leave it. Leave it behind.
Let it go, man.
Let it go.
I know.
Oh, but it's just missed opportunities, isn't it, Tommy? We know what it's like when you know you're that close but that far and you let it slip and it's just like, it's deflating, isn't it?
Guys, I'm not even Australian and I was, I was watching it and I couldn't believe it. So, yeah.
Oh, deflating. Anyway, let's move on to the Premier League. It's the bread and butter, isn't it? It is like the best league in the world. Let's not beat around the bush, isn't it, Phil? Best league in the world.
It's definitely in the top two.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, Liverpool, Arsenal, that was the fixture of the weekend. Absolutely enormous win for Arsenal. Phil, how do you feel? I mean, you know, being on the other side, really, North London, but, you know, you're the white side. But what did you think in general about the performance of Arsenal and the magnitude of the game?
You know, Schwartzy, when we talk about other teams on the podcast, I take my Spurs hat off and I am completely impartial, you know, totally professional, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
You know that we've been doing this podcast enough. Listen, I thought Arsenal, I didn't think it was an incredible performance from Arsenal. I think they did well. I felt that they were sort of handed a lifeline by Liverpool's defending. I mean, when it's 1-1 and Arsenal are trying to find a way to score the second goal, but it didn't necessarily feel like it was coming. And then they're handed this gift of a second goal, and then they take the lead, and Liverpool kind of lose their heads a little bit. I felt that they went a little bit wild. They didn't know how to sort of channel their emotions, and they lost their heads a little bit, and that played into the Arsenal's hands. And then they went on and scored a third. But yeah, listen, they got the result, which was obviously the most important thing. I think it was a good performance from Arsenal, but I think they were helped considerably by a strangely, like, bizarrely poor performance from Liverpool all over the pitch, really, because defensively they weren't great, and in the midfield they were sort of weak. They missed Szoboszlai. They didn't have any control there, really. I actually thought it was quite a strange game. It wasn't, as a neutral watching, and I am a neutral watching despite being a Spurs fan, I was watching it from a neutral perspective. I felt that it was a bit sort of chaotic. It didn't feel like anyone had control. It didn't feel like this is technically a brilliant match of football. It was kind of wild and kind of end to end, and things were happening, but it didn't feel like a brilliant football match.
Tommy, was it Arsenal's performance in that first 45 minutes, or was it Liverpool just not being at the levels we're used to seeing them?
I think it was a combination of both. I think that, you know, the way that Arsenal kind of flooded the midfield, you obviously touched on, you know, Liverpool's midfield and defence not being up to scratch. And I think that's exactly right. But I think that Arsenal's positions and the position that Arsenal's midfield got themselves into just posed problems, tactical problems that Liverpool couldn't deal with. And I think that a lot of Liverpool's problems were tactical. I think that, you know, the way Arsenal was playing out from the back, that their midfield would get the ball and turn and seem to have a lot of space to run into. I think that was a big problem for Liverpool. The spaces between the lines were uncharacteristically big. And also, I think, you know, it was two big mistakes for two of the goals, or at least one for sure. With Van Dijk, obviously, first of all, letting the ball bounce. I think that was a costly mistake, which obviously went on to lead to him and Alisson having that mix-up. But, you know, that's such an out of character thing for Van Dijk to do something like that. And I think that was, something that, you know, had that not happened, you could see maybe Liverpool working themselves back into the game. But just key personnel making big mistakes was costly for Liverpool.
But that's the thing, right? So when you don't have, like, the Szoboszlai, but then, look, okay, let me just backtrack there. So Szoboszlai is missing.
Yeah.
And Salah's missing. And then, but they've done it in the past without big name players, Salah without being in the side, and they've performed far better. The space in midfield, if you give Jorginho space in midfield, he's going to hurt you. He's going to look like the old Jorginho, I'll get it right in a second, who came when he first came to England, when he was playing at Napoli and then he first came to England. I was surprised at how much space he was given and how Liverpool weren't able to be on the front foot and close the spaces down as well as they usually do. Because Liverpool, that's normally their game. That's the thing that they do so, so well. So I want to know, do you think also, Tommy, is that a case because no one, Darwin Núñez wasn't there, the way they set up, or they just weren't on their game?
Yeah, I think it was probably a combination of a few things. But I think that, like you just mentioned, I think obviously one of the hallmarks of Liverpool's kind of style of play is suffocating the opposition in such a high energy, high octane style. And, you know, if you're 5% off and you're 1 or 2 seconds too slow to get to the ball or to apply pressure, teams like Arsenal can just rip you apart. And I think that's they seemed low on energy, or they just weren't as sharp as they normally were. And the flow on effect of that is that players become isolated, and, you know, all of a sudden you have the likes of Saka and Martinelli and all these kind of players running at your defenders one against one. And that's kind of what we saw in the game. And I think that, you know, it's hard to, I think that it's difficult to blame Liverpool's midfielders alone, because obviously they got heavily exposed, but I think they were more of a symptom of what was happening all over the pitch rather than it being their fault specifically. And like you said, Sportsy, obviously if you throw in a few of the key players missing, it's probably a completely different story. But, you know, like you said, they've kind of dealt with that in the past, not having them available, but on this occasion they were unable to.
Schwartzy, can we talk about what happened with that second goal, please? Can you talk us through what's going on there with Alisson and Van Dijk?
Well, Tommy touched on it before. Van Dijk, if he doesn't let the ball bounce, it's dealt with. Get your head through it, get your foot through it, whatever. It's done with. But the way that the game is being played today, it's about retention of possession. Get the ball. It doesn't matter, regardless of how dangerous a position it may be, how awkward a position it is, we're going to play out of it. And for me, that was a classic example of trying to overplay, trying to play something and make something so much more difficult than it should have been. It should have been just basic defending. Get your foot through it, get your head behind it and through it and out and away. So
you're blaming Van Dijk?
The first mistake for me is that, right?
Okay.
That's the first, like, error in judgment. And then the second one, of course, is the misunderstanding. Because once you do let the ball bounce and it pops up like that, and it's a case, and I've been in that situation so many times. Do I come? Do I not come? Am I caught in no man's land? Is he going to put something through it in the end? Is, you know, there's a collision that's going to happen. There's all these things that are running through your head in split seconds that you have to make a decision. So then it's a combination of both making bad calls, bad decisions, and the confusion is then compounded. And of course, the only player that's watching the ball in the end sticks the ball in the back of the net. Mm-hmm. You know, Van Dijk actually continues to watch the ball after Alisson comes out. He's got half a chance to get in the right position to potentially even block it or clear it still afterwards. But he turns away and looks away from the ball. So there's a number of mistakes there. And at the end of the day, both of them accountable for it. And it is an uncharacteristic mistake from two incredible players.
Third goal, there was no question about Alisson. I mean, he got nutmegged, but that's nothing to do with him, really. Or
it's just, you know what? When I first saw it, I thought, wow, that's a bad mistake.
Yeah.
And then obviously I've seen it on a number of occasions on the replay, and it takes a deflection.
Yeah.
That short distance takes a deflection. It looks worse because of the way Alisson's standing. And then the goal beforehand. So everyone's going, oh God, he's having a stinker because he's made that mistake. He's been involved in that goal, and now he's got one between his legs from that distance. And it looked very awkward, and it looked very technically poor in the way he went for it, but it was a big deflection. So when things don't go in your favor, they don't go in your favor, right? So it was one of those nights where things just went against him from that point onwards, and it looks bad. It looks poor.
And the first goal where he makes a save and pushes it to Saka?
Yeah, look, I think it was one of those nights where it wasn't his best evenings. And okay. I think he could have done a lot better. And this is where it's interesting, the criticism or the critique, is that when you're critiquing certain players, you critique them at different levels because of the ability of each individual player. And that's what people get a little bit clouded about, is that you go, well, hang on, you know, you're being so harsh. Well, his bar is so high. His level of performances day in, day out, week in, week out is so incredibly high, there is a level of expectation. And the expectation is that Alisson actually normally on another occasion doesn't concede any goals last night because he's that good, and they are kind of pretty they're pretty standard saves for him normally, or situations. And bearing in mind the second one is a joint effort and the first decision was the incorrect decision by Virgil van Dijk. So, you know, that's where it's a cluttered one and it's a difficult one, but you've got to hold your hand up. I mean, I'm sure he walked in the change room and went, look, wasn't my day tonight and I'm sorry, guys, it's my mistake.
Shortsy, I'm impressed. as a sort of fully paid up member of the goalkeepers union, that was a very measured response. So yeah, that was good.
No, because I know what it's like. You've been there and you've done that and you've been in that situation and you know that you should have done so much better. You know, you would have done on another day, you would have made that save. That's saves that you make week in, week out. And there are reasons as to why it happened. And one of them, certainly the second goal, was the initial decision, like I said, was out of his hands, but then compounding afterwards.
And it's a bit like what Tommy said, isn't it? Because he said, you know, the outfield players were maybe 5% down on their level. And if Alisson's 5% down on his level as well, then it's a really high level. So just drop a little bit and we get these kind of mistakes.
Yeah. Often though, like, because his level is so high, dropping 5% isn't such a big deal, right? But I think the way that Liverpool play and the risk sort of kind of type of game that they play, like Man City does, Arsenal to a degree, not same level, but they do. They need everybody to be at those high levels every week to win games. And they generally are. And that's why they are so successful. That's why they're ruthless. That's why they're able to continue. So my big question is now, what does this do? Does this put a seed of doubt now for Liverpool, Tommy? And then I'm going to ask you, Phil, afterwards about Arsenal. Does this put them right back in the mix and are they genuine contenders?
All right, Tommy first.
Yeah, for me, no, for Liverpool. We've seen, you know, in the years gone by, I think it was last season as well, where Liverpool had a heavy defeat to Villa at the start of the season. And that, with Klopp, they've always seemed to bounce back and have some kind of response. And I think that's what everybody will be expecting from them kind of next week. But you know, it was obviously their first loss of the season. Second loss of the season, but first loss in quite a while. And, you know, the way that they're as you just mentioned, obviously the way they play, if they get exposed just a little bit, it can make it seem much worse than it really is. And I think that, you know, playing, they're not going to play the likes of Arsenal every week and they're not going to be as exposed as they were in this game. So I think that, you know, that there's for sure some learnings that they'll have to take from that game. And probably, you know, probably really, really need some players back from injury, I think, as well. But at the same time, I don't think that it's going to be a story of kind of a make or break for their season. I still personally think that they're, you know, it's going to be them or City that's going to go on to win it.
So you're asking me if Arsenal are going to win the league, Shortsy?
No, I'm asking you, are they a genuine contender now? They've not lost against any of the top six teams this season.
Listen, they're a genuine contender because they're, you know, 2 points off top spot. So of course they are. Okay, City have two games in hand, and if they win them, they will be top. But Arsenal are in there after 23 games. You're 2 points off the top. You're in, and you're Arsenal as well. You have the experience of last season. Yeah, you are a contender. I think what we need to see from Arsenal, what Arsenal fans will want to see, is them trying to go on a Man City-esque run of winning game after game after game, because that's evidently what you need to do to win a league title. And this season, their biggest run of consecutive victories is 4, which is, you know, it's not massive. They're currently on a run of 3. They're away at West Ham next week. So let's see if they can put together a run of consecutive victories. And that's what you need to keep pace with Manchester City and to a lesser extent Liverpool as well. So yeah, they are contenders, much more than Spurs. You know, I'm putting it out there, much more than Spurs. And at the moment, it's a 3-horse race. Obviously, by the time people are listening to this podcast, they will know what Manchester City will have done against Brentford, which could condition how we view things a little bit. But the feeling is still that City are going to put win after win together and go on to win the title. But I am. You asked me last week, I think, about Liverpool, and we were talking about Klopp and can he go out on a high? And I said, yeah, I think they can. They can win the title, and I quite fancy them. This result does dent those aspirations, but they've got a winnable run of fixtures now, a really winnable run of fixtures. So, and they've got a Carabao Cup final to boost them as well. So, I think Liverpool will bounce back.
Yeah, for me, Man City all the way still. I know they've got, in just under 9.5 hours time, they're playing Brentford away, which is have its challenges, which it always does. But I still think Man City will win the league. But I'm hoping for a very, very tightly contested competition all the way to the end. Right, let's move on to the beloved Spurs, Phil. Phil, are you pulling your hair out? Like, honestly, I mean, you've got a great head of hair, right? That's brilliant. I mean,
I'm jealous.
So are you pulling your hair out about Spurs? And this is the frustration with Ange, right? Because they play attractive football, attacking football, but they're always going to play. They're always going to continue to play regardless of the situation in the game.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I was obviously massively frustrated when they conceded in injury time to draw 2-2 with Everton this weekend, not for the first time. And producer Elliot's given us some rather infuriating stats that Spurs have conceded 8 goals in injury time this season, more than any other team. But if you flip that, Spurs have also scored goals in injury time as well. There was the two injury time goals against Sheffield United. There was an injury time winner against Liverpool. There was that injury time equaliser against Man City. So it just feels like it's kind of what's going on now. It's just full on, full throttle, right to the edge for better or worse. And obviously Tommy's played under Ange and knows a little bit about his mentality. I mean, was that something that he was aware of when he was coaching? Were you guys aware of? Did you concede late goals? Or did you feel like you were tired towards the end of games, mentally, physically?
No, not really. I think that Schwartzy kind of touched on it, the playing under all scenarios and not wavering from his philosophy regardless of the context of the game. And that is 100% true. I think that I distinctly remember, at training, Ange even saying, he used to say something, it was like, don't play the scoreboard or the clock, just play our game. So
you can see that. You can see that. Yeah.
And he used to say it all the time. And I think I wouldn't say if it's a result of that, because I actually agree with it. But I think that what happens is because, it gets to the back end of a game and naturally as a player, you'll go into a kind of negative mindset to protect this lead. And
a bit like the Socceroos did. Oh, I brought the Socceroos up again.
Exactly. But I think that, it's obviously a hard thing to apply because, players aren't robots. There's an emotion. There's a human element to it. And when there's 5 minutes left and you're exhausted, you naturally want to retreat and protect your lead. Like it's a thing. It's an understandable kind of decision that you would subconsciously make. But I think that if you can kind of, look past that and, the reason that Spurs was winning the game was because they did everything right and they did everything, respected the process before that. So why stop doing it? That's what Ange would say. So I think it's kind of hard to argue with that logic. And I think that, he's obviously only 6 months into this tenure. And I think that as he gets more, he's obviously got the buy-in and belief of the players. But I think that as he gets his own squad and he can also make the substitutes that he wants, he can make substitutes that'll make more of an impact on the game. I think that these kind of things can stop this kind of trend from happening because it was something when he first came to Brisbane Roar when I had him as a manager that was a bit of a trend. There used to be, similar to this, we would win some games at the death and lose some, and then kind of as the ship became more stable, it tended just to be on the positive side. We tended just to get late goals for ourselves and not concede. And I think that it was purely down to this and just respecting the process and not playing the scoreboard or the clock.
That's great to hear. I'm very, very encouraged by that because, and listen, as a fan, and now I'm not talking as a journalist, I'm talking as a fan. As a fan, yes, I was massively frustrated to concede that goal, but you're sort of heartened by what you were saying. You can see that there is an idea. You can see that they're still trying to play right until the death, and we're behind that idea, I think. So it's frustrating, but at the same time it's heartening to see Spurs playing such good football, and disappointing to seeing them concede late goals. But if you're telling me, Tommy, which you are, you're definitely telling me it's going to get better, it's going to improve, then we do trust the process. And Spurs have dropped 18 points from winning positions so far this season, but I think part of that is because they've scored first in so many games. They've come flying out of the blocks, and it's just a something that I've seen time and time again, making this incredible start. And I guess it's just a matter of being able to maintain that throughout 90 minutes. Scored first in 17 of the 23 matches. It's really impressive how Spurs have started it. And if, as you say, given time, they can, you know, interiorize some of the things that he wants them to do better and can keep it going for 90 minutes, then, yeah, I hear what you're saying, Tommy. I agree. Spurs are definitely going to win the league next year.
you mentioned it before about you believed in the philosophy and like agreed with it, and you wanted to play and continue to play and play in that sort of positive attitude sort of style of football. Was that a general consensus amongst all the players as well? Was it ever discussed afterwards? I remember you played Thailand away. I'm not sure if you were involved, where you drew 2-2 in the end, and you needed Mila Jednak to score two penalties.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very fortunate result, really.
Yeah.
The conditions, I mean, it's different national team playing in Asian football, right? We all know that because of the conditions that we know that as players. I don't think the general public understand it fully because of the conditions, right? The extreme heat, the humidity, the pitch conditions. Playing at that intensity for such a long period of time, even in normal conditions like here in England, is not easy, right? That is really draining and very tough mentally to deal with.
Yeah.
It wasn't very humid at the
time. No, of course.
No, I think it all kind of goes back to Ange's whole philosophy, because if you look at other managers, if you look at, you know, a Mourinho, he will assess a game on its own merit and say, what do I need to do to win the particular challenges of this game? And Ange, he has his way of doing things, and he's uncompromising and unwavering, and his ability to make players believe in that is his strength, actually. So I think for him to for one game to change something, it plants a seed of doubt in a player's mind, and the ongoing consequences of doing that will be worse than maybe winning that game but not adhering to his principles. And I think that, you know, Ange's plan B is to do plan A better. There's only plan A. So I think that, you know, you can critique that philosophy all you like, but that's how he operates. And I think that the way he gets such good buy-in is because he believes so wholeheartedly in it, so you do as well. And I think that, you know, not changing is, although sometimes maybe seen as a mistake, I think that's also his strength in a weird way.
I get that. I can see that. I can understand that. But you and I both know, in that change room, in Spurs' instance, this season they've dropped 18 points from winning positions.
Yep.
Players know that. You know how many games you've dropped points in winning positions where you think, had we have changed a little bit, even for those last 5 minutes, out of those 18 points, we may have kept 10.
Yeah. 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 But I think that the flip side of that is, you know, if you say the last 10 minutes of a game, we're just going to defend and backs against the wall. And I'm not saying that's the wrong solution, but the next game, some player might get the wrong idea and start doing it from the 60th minute because he's feeling a bit tired or something. It just creates a problem that he doesn't want to exist, basically. He just wants players that will do what his plan on the field, implement it, and if you can't do it, then that's it. And it also, I think it's easy to be accountable when everybody knows what the plan is, and, you know, you either did it successfully or you didn't, and you always know the reasons why, if you weren't successful, why you weren't. I think that whilst I kind of agree, you know, towards the end of a game, sometimes you got to do the dirty, you know, roll your socks up and do what needs doing. I just know that he will never do that. So I'm just trying to explain things from how I think he sees it. But I also understand why he does that, because it's not about that one game. He sees it more on the big picture and implementing a philosophy, and he doesn't want to undermine that. I think that's kind of the scenario that's happening here.
Well, next we got the WSL, as it was in action again this weekend. There was a shock result in a game involving five of our Matildas. Here's Narelle and Ash to tell you all about it.
Thanks, guys. Well, yes, West Ham, who've been flirting with relegation all season, managed to upset high-flying Arsenal, who, Ash, as we know, have been chasing Chelsea and the title all season. I mean, we have been waiting for one of the chasing teams to blink, and that was Arsenal.
It was Arsenal, wasn't it? And you probably wouldn't expect it with the quality of the squad that they had. But I think it also goes to show, like, the work that West Ham has done to improve themselves in the January transfer window. I think now they're dangerous for, like, almost any team that they're going to come up against. You know, second from the bottom of the table probably doesn't truly reflect their squad strength. So, I mean, they're off that now, aren't they? But they'll be going pretty well moving into the future.
Yeah, 11th to 9th, and actually they became the first team in the WSL to name a starting 11 that did not feature an English player. As we know, two of those are Australian.
Yeah.
And their fans are loving Katrina Gorry.
Oh, and rightfully so. I think it's, well, did she get the fans player of the match again this week?
Yep.
You know, they're loving her and she's doing great things for them, like her ability to play, you know, little passes through the midfield has been revolutionary for them, as well as the defensive work, which we've spoken about, I think, in the past.
And Katrina Gorry actually gave us a really good insight to being a mum and a footballer. She posted on social media after the match saying that when she arrived for the game, her kid was sick all through the car, had to take her home, change her, wash her, got back just in time for the warm-up, which I don't know if that was another team, they might have probably dropped her.
Yeah, exactly. It's great to see, you know, how far the workplace has come for footballers. You know, there'd be a time in the past where there'd be like a no babies rule sort of thing. And now she's doing something that every parent probably has experienced, you know, having to do a run back for a sick kid. And it's great to see the development of football as a workplace in West Ham. And hopefully, you know, Gorry can repay, you know, everything that she can with continuing good performances.
And we've actually had our first sacking in the WSL this season. Brighton manager Mal Phillips is gone, and maybe that will start a trend, because you don't want to be the first team to do it. Now that someone has, maybe more will follow, like Arsenal and Jonas Iderville. You mentioned before, they are stacked. They've got Leah Williamson fully back from her ACL injury, Beth Mead, Viviana Miedema. I mean, I could just go on.
Yeah, you could list the whole squad as quality players, couldn't you? And I mean, the Mal Phillips one, we could do a whole another podcast on, I think. You know, she's was a bit hard done by there, but I'm sure Jonas Iderville is under pressure. I mean, he's got a world-class squad there, and I think he's had enough time with that squad, despite injuries, to sort of get consistent results out of them. So I sort of wonder, you know, what they're going to do there. And they've also got some, you know, tough fixtures coming up. Is it time to look elsewhere? I don't know.
Well, it's almost an unwritten rule in the WSL, three strikes and you're out. No side has won the title with three losses next to their name. And they've got a very important week coming up, two knockout cup matches.
Yeah, it's a big week for them. And then to follow that, a big fixture in the WSL. I mean, by the time we get back for the women's football wrap, we could have a new coach in the hot seat for Arsenal.
We could. Look, we've just been hating on Arsenal this week, Schwartzy, but is it fair to expect more from this team?
Yes, I think it is very fair to say that we expect a lot more from Arsenal. I had them tipped as potentially going on winning the WSL this season, even more so off the back of being knocked out of the Champions League. Very disappointed. Having watched the game against West Ham, the number of chances that, again, Arsenal created was unbelievable. A combination of poor finishing, actually mostly poor finishing, and some good goalkeeping prevented them from scoring. So that is a big, big problem for Arsenal moving forward. With all the attacking powers that they do have and they possess, they're not utilizing it. There just doesn't seem to be the right combinations being found at the moment for Arsenal moving forward. And look, there's a lot of positives to be taken in terms of they're the only team to beat Chelsea this year, and they not just beat them, they beat them convincingly at the Emirates. So that's another reason why I can't understand why they're off the pace like they are. And certainly that performance against West Ham was a big, big blow in any of their chances of winning the WSL this season. If you want to hear more about all the WSL action at the weekend, then the Women's Football Wrap is now on the Optus Sport app. Next up, we're going to chat La Liga, but first, here's a taste of what we've got coming up on Optus Sport.
It's a massive month ahead. February on Optus Sport.
Feb 7 and 8, quarterfinals of the men's DFB Pokal. Feb 11, the top two go toe-to-toe. Real Madrid, Girona. Feb 12, can the Hammers upset Arsenal again? And Villa out to break their Man United hoodoo. Feb 18 and 19, City-Chelsea twice. Replay of the 4-4 thriller, then a top-of-the-table clash. Feb 24, it's Ange's turn to take on Chelsea.
All in February on Optus Sport.
So, Phil, La Liga, it's your bread and butter. You think it's one of the top two leagues in the world? Okay. All right.
It's definitely up there.
I'm not going to argue with you right now, right? It is definitely very, very good. And it's entertaining. But the Madrid derby, talk us through it. You were at the game. What was it like being there? I watched the game and dogged performance from Atletico Madrid. Kind of managed the game. Real, a little bit disappointing.
Potentially, yeah. Obviously, it finished 1-1, for those who don't know. Atletico Madrid scoring in the 94th minute to claim a draw, which was, not that important for them, but it's actually really important for the title race because it means that Real Madrid stay just a couple of points above Girona. And next week, it's Real Madrid against Girona. So that's a terrific game for everybody to watch on Optus Sport. The game itself, listen, Real Madrid were playing with their centre-back pairing was their fourth and sixth choice centre-backs. They had Danny Carvajal playing as a centre-back. Danny Carvajal is a 5'8" right-back. He is not a centre-back, and he actually did pretty well, apart from in the 94th minute when him and Nacho got mixed up and Marcos Llorente took full advantage. So it was a patched-up Real Madrid team. They lost Vinicius in the warm-up as well, so Brahim Diaz came on into the starting 11 and played brilliantly, really, really brilliantly, scored a good goal as well and was a constant menace. So it was Diego Simeone afterwards said it's a weird game. It was a weird game. I don't know what you guys felt. That's what he said. But I felt it was a weird game. And it was a little bit because neither side played brilliantly, but both sides had pretty good chances. Atleti, I think they just figured out quite quickly that Real Madrid have got this really weird centre-back pairing. Let's put loads of crosses into the box and see what happens. And they caused problems with every single corner. So, yeah, it wasn't in terms of a spectacle. We'd had some Madrid derbies in recent weeks in the Copa del Rey and the Spanish Super Cup that were really quite thrilling, going to extra time and terrific, terrific matches. This was different. Obviously, it was a league game. It wasn't in a cup tournament. So the context was a little bit different. But I was at the stadium. And when you're at a stadium and you're at a derby and it's a game with some chances, I actually felt it was quite entertaining. So I was sitting there in the stadium watching it, feeling, yeah, this was quite an entertaining game. Maybe guys watching at home had a sort of different view of it. And the Madrid derby is an interesting one in terms of the actual rivalry, because Real Madrid are so much bigger than Atletico Madrid in terms of success, in terms of global reach, in terms of wealth. They are massive. And yet, Atletico Madrid are still able to compete with them consistently. They have been able to beat them to league titles, beat them to Copa del Rey titles. They've caused them problems. They've beaten them this season twice. So it's just a really interesting dynamic, the way that these two sets of supporters and these two clubs meet every time in this cross city rival. And I was trying to compare it to other derbies around Europe, and it's kind of unique because if you think about other big cross city derbies, Milan derby, well they're both huge. Liverpool are much bigger than Everton, and Everton can't really compete with Liverpool. Manchester, you know, that's completely off the scale in terms of imbalance. I don't know. This is quite unique because it is an imbalance rivalry, but at the same time, Atletico compete really, really heavily. So I think it's the biggest cross city derby in Europe. Mark, I was trying to think about this, and no other city has had two Champions League finals with two teams from that city. It's a massive deal, and at the same time, it gets eclipsed by El Clásico in terms of Spanish football because that is a bigger fixture. But this is a big deal. This is a big deal. I don't
know. See, that's a big call. That Tommy, are you buying into that one? I mean, I'm thinking about the Milan derby. I know what you're saying. Two teams, two big derby, so rivals that have played each other in a Champions League final. But there's some big ones. There's some, yeah, some massive ones.
Yeah, obviously Milan, you just touched on. But aside from that, it's hard to think of too many other examples. Maybe
London's so big. London, there's so many different derbies within London. And none of them, even Arsenal Spurs, you know, in terms of visceral sort of hatred and passion, yeah. In terms of a big fixture between two European powerhouses, it's not.
Yeah. Well, City United were probably the closest. Obviously, United have dropped off, but City United still, I think, is still right up there with being a huge, huge fixture and rivalry and hatred and everything else. So,
and I guess with that one, the gap, you know, the quality of United and City's only recently become quite similar. You know, so
yeah.
You know, if you're going back in a longer kind of scale or a bigger scale, there probably was a bit more of a gulf in class between the two teams, whereas Atletico was, you know, on a historical timeline, maybe more competitive than City used to be. So it is different from that perspective, I guess. But, I'm looking forward to hopefully getting to one of the games one day because it sounds like a great experience.
Tommy, you mentioned off air earlier on your favourite player was Thierry Henry. That's why you supported Arsenal. But now you actually support Spurs because of Ange, which is, I mean, Phil's happy about it.
Welcome, Tommy. Welcome.
Antoine Griezmann, what do you make of him? As in, he's one of those players I always feel, Phil and I have had this discussion in the past about him. I get frustrated by him because I think he's unbelievable at times, but then other times I think he's lazy. Like last night, I thought again, there were times where, Phil's not agreeing with me, but I'm not convinced.
Yeah. No, well, obviously I think that, you know, his time in Barcelona kind of put a bit of a dent in everybody's mind of the caliber of him because, you know, at the time when he transferred to Barcelona and he was playing for France, he was on fire and, you know, he had the kind of world at his feet. I think he was, you know, number three player in the world in the Ballon d'Or that year. He was flying. But I think that there was a few years there when he was at Barcelona where you could tell his confidence was severely dented. But I think this season he's kind of found maybe not quite the level he had before he went to Barcelona, but very close. And I think that it's been he's been fantastic. And, you know, like you said, this was quite a peculiar game. So he wasn't necessarily at his best the whole game, but in there were some key passes and some key moments where he you could see his quality. And you know, I personally love watching him play, but I do agree. I think he is a little bit of an enigma, and it's hard to pinpoint, you know, why sometimes he does seem to go missing in games. But yeah, you know, overall I thought that, you know, in this game he was quite influential. But I do think, just going back to this game, however, though, I do think that Real Madrid was probably a little bit unlucky. I'm not sure what you guys think, but to have a couple of penalties, I think there was two moments where the legs got tangled in the box, and I thought that, you know, maybe one of them in particular deserved maybe looking at a bit further. But I'm not sure if you saw it. But yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people have talked about that here, Tommy, because in Spain, let me just, you know, in Spain, people just love to talk about penalties, love to talk about referees. Don't actually like talking about football that much, but they do love talking about the referees. So, yeah, obviously Real Madrid fans claiming that there should have been at least a couple of penalties given on Jude Bellingham, I think. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's one that I don't think it's for VAR to decide. I think it's, if the referee sees it and decides it's not a penalty, then he's decided it's not a penalty. I don't think it's a flagrant mistake for the VAR to get involved. Although, if I was a referee, I might possibly have given it. But that's not what VAR is for, I don't think.
Yeah.
So the other massive news, of course, in world football regarding Real Madrid as well is Mbappe. Supposedly, he's decided he wants to go to Real Madrid now, Phil. Are we even going to believe this? Because we've heard this before. We've been here before. We're now a couple of years down the line. And he's still, don't forget. Well, yeah, but don't forget, he still has the option to lengthen his contract at PSG for another year.
Yes, Mark, he does, which he has done in the past consistently. So, yes. Listen, this feels like it is a pretty serious confirmation that it is on. Various different sources have been suggesting that it is happening, but this has been going on for 6 years now, so it is difficult to fully accept that it might actually finally happen. But guys, I think that it might actually finally happen. This feels like the closest we've ever had to it being 100% confirmed. And listen, if this happens, it's terrific for Real Madrid. And really bad news for the rest of La Liga, because I think it's just going to elevate Real Madrid to a level where they're not going to be caught for some time. And Barcelona being in the straits that they're in, financially, they cannot compete with the level of signing, and their squad is not at the level to compete with Real Madrid if Mbappe comes in. Atleti have a really, really good squad, really, really talented squad, but I feel like Mbappe just elevates Real Madrid's team to the next level. And yeah, it's bad news for the rest of the teams in La Liga if Mbappe comes, because Real Madrid is just going to be so much better. But it's going to be fantastic to watch him finally, to see where and how he fits into this team, whether he's on the left where Vinicius Jr. likes to play, whether it's through the middle. Is there a place for Rodrigo? How does Jude Bellingham link up with him? There's a lot of things that we can and will analyse as and when this is finalised. But at the time of recording, it isn't. But it's so it's so well sourced, this story, that I think we can be close to getting excited, because it feels like it might finally be happening.
Tommy, is he the best player, Mbappe? Is he that good? Is he worth that much? Is he worth the wait? Is he worth all the aggravation?
I always thought with Mbappe it was an interesting one, because it's, you know, I think Real Madrid is the club for him. I think that he wouldn't fit, you know, a Barcelona. His personality and, you know, it's the Mbappe show. You know, he's the center of attention. Everything revolves around him. You can see that at PSG now and the whole soap opera that we've just discussed. He loves the attention. He kind of relishes in it. And I personally would love to see him go there. And I think that, you know, I can understand the value, and I think that he would live up to the expectations, because, you know, the Vinicius, Mbappe, Bellingham, you just touched on all the players. I think that makes Real Madrid's front third comfortably the best in the world if he goes there. And I don't just think it'll be the other teams in Spain, but all the other teams in Europe that are hoping that doesn't eventuate, to be honest.
I think you've just upset a whole lot of Liverpool and Man City fans. I mean, Liverpool, look, Man City are the best team in the world. Let's be honest. They are treble winners, best team on the planet right now. So you think with Mbappe, Real Madrid will be the best front three?
I do, actually. I think that, you know, PSG, the only reason they've kind of, and obviously they've been very underwhelming in recent times, but the only reason they've been kind of competitive at all is because of him. In recent seasons. And I think that, you know, what Mbappe does for France, you know, he's remarkable, and nobody else in the world can do that. And I think that that's what Real Madrid would be looking at. And
Messi,
Messi's in a different discussion, but okay, maybe Messi 5 years ago, but you know, the pace of Mbappe, it just adds an element that no one else in the world has. And, you know, Haaland, for example, he's, you know, one of the, you know, it's those two. That's the discussion. And they're obviously completely different in terms of style. But I personally would love to see Mbappe at Real Madrid over Haaland if that was the choice.
Right, Phil. # always watch Girona. I watch them.
Good.
0-0. Like, honestly, I tell you what.
Did you actually watch this?
Of course I did.
This was an exciting 0-0. It wasn't a snooze fest, as producer Elliot's put on the rundown. This was an exciting game.
No, I don't know about an exciting game, right? So no goals, and it was frustrating. And to be fair, I'll hold my hand up. You took personal responsibility for lack of goals, guys. And I accepted your apology. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, Shorty messaged me going, I'm watching Girona, there's no goals, so boring. Yeah, I was just like, well, all right, I'm sorry. It's absolutely my fault. To be fair, it is my fault, because I've been ramming it down your throat to always watch them. So. I thought this was an entertaining game. They drew 0-0 with Real Sociedad, who are a very good team in the Champions League, and came there and gave them a good game. And actually, this turned into be not such a bad result for Girona's very unexpected title push, because of that 94th minute goal from Marcos Llorente at the Bernabeu last night. So it's Real Madrid on 58 points, Girona on 56 points, and then they meet at the Bernabeu on Saturday. Another game which I've very surprisingly managed to get access for, Mark. So Tommy Schwartz gives me stick because I missed the last Madrid derby at the Metropolitano a few months ago because I wasn't feeling very well. I had a ticket, but I didn't go. And he cannot believe that I didn't go. And he's been giving me stick basically every single week on every single podcast. I'm not going to that. Last night, I was feeling a little bit ill, actually. And I thought, I've got to go to this one, because if I don't go to this one, he's never going to let me on a podcast again. So I'm going to Real Madrid against Girona, and I'm looking forward to it, because if Llorente hadn't scored that goal in the 94th minute, Real Madrid would be 4 points clear. They beat Girona. They're 7 points clear of them. And it's more or less, title done. Yeah. It's not, though. It is fully game on. And if Girona win at the Bernabeu, they go a point clear. So we've got a real title race in La Liga between two unexpected teams.
Is it possible, though? Girona lost, obviously, at home to Real Madrid 3-0. It's the only game they've lost at home this season.
Yes.
Do you see them going to the Bernabeu and getting a result?
They're missing two key players who are suspended. Daley Blind, centre-back, he's suspended. And Yangel Herrera in midfield, he's suspended as well. The manager's suspended as well. It was quite a fiery game against the Real Sociedad. I think they cannot lose. And, you know, if they don't lose, then they're still in it because it's still only 2 points. I think winning might be a very difficult ask, but I think they can go there and not lose and keep the title race going. Yeah, I do.
Barcelona continue the winning ways, winning away at Alaves post Xavi announcement that he's leaving into the season. Just sort of kind of keeps them in the running, 8 points off.
It kind of keeps them in the running. Yeah, I mean, the good news for them is Vitor Roque scoring, the new signing who scored in two consecutive games now. He then got sent off in a slightly questionable second yellow card. But that's good news for them. And it was a slightly better performance. I still think it's not vintage Barcelona by any means. And I still don't see this massive reaction from the players feeling liberated after Xavi announced that he was leaving at the end of the season. But, you know, it's two wins out of two since he made this announcement. So maybe there has been some kind of small reaction. But I don't know, midweek, they beat Osasuna 1-0 in a really kind of drab game. And it was heard Xavi, he was speaking to us on the coverage on Opta Sport. And we heard him say, you know, I'm really happy. We played really well. We saw a definite reaction. And everybody's kind of looking at each other in the studio. Really? Does he actually believe this? Or is he just... Because he's such a positive guy, Xavi, that he comes out and he says this and we won and we saw a reaction and we played well. And I mean, that wasn't the case. Certainly not against Osasuna. Against Alaves, it was marginally better, but it's still not amazing. But hey, they won two games out of two. So let's see if they can keep on winning.
Just a reminder, that game, Girona against Real Madrid next weekend, is, of course, live on Optus Sport. That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much, Phil, again, for joining us.
Thanks, Shorty.
And thanks, Tommy. Thanks for having you on the podcast. Great to see you after quite a long time. I think you mentioned earlier on, over a year since we've seen each other last.
It has been. So, thanks for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Excellent stuff. Remember, you can watch every game of the Premier League, La Liga and the WSL live and exclusive on Optus Sport. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.